Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and today we're going to be talking about something that affects the clients that you're working with, the injured people who are being represented by the attorneys who are your clients, and perhaps you yourself. We're going to be talking about relationships and marriages and couples and what kinds of things pull them apart and what kinds of things keep you together. I have with me Heather Garbutt, who's an expert in the creation of positive dynamics in relationships. She's a psychotherapist who I met in a course that I just finished called The Business of Speaking. And I thought it would be interesting to have you hear from a love and relationships coach. Her practice extends across the globe, and she's speaking with us today from Great Britain. Heather, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Patricia. It's lovely, lovely to be here for you both you and your audience.
Well, thank you. I know that this is probably the $64,000 question, as we say in the States. Everyone wants to know, what does it take to be able to have a happy and healthy relationship?
I always go to the Gottmans, John and Julia Gottman. I think her surname is Schwartz Gottman. There's a beautiful quote from them, which I'll read actually to make sure I've got it right. Successful long-term relationships are created through small words, small gestures, and small acts. A lifetime of love is created every single day that you are together. Getting to know your partner doesn't end the minute you return the moving van and a sharing dresser and drawer space, or the minute you say, I do. It never ends. I love the real heart in that. You know, they just capture it so beautifully. They've been researching couple relationships for decades, and they can tell within an hour and a half of meeting a couple if they're likely to stay together well and happily, or if they're likely to draw apart. And they can do that with 94% accuracy, which is absolutely breathtaking, I think.
Mm-hmm. So then, of course, everybody wants to know, what are the Gottmans looking for, and what do they spot in those interactions that give them that high level of predictability?
Well, for the people, they look for the people who are likely to stay together. They look for these particular qualities. I'll list them out. The couples will listen to each other warmly. They make good eye contact that's loving. They look at each other with affection, and they demonstrate affection. They show patience, and they're really interested when they're listening. It's not idle listening, it's really active listening. They pay attention. And if they're talking about each other, then they'll tell stories from a point of view of appreciation, admiration, a pride in each other, or gentle, affectionate amusement with each other's quirkiness and foibles. Really delightful. And they have a sense of we together, rather than a feeling of me. They pull together rather than apart. They make plans together, which includes the health of the relationship. And that would also include what's good for each of them, but it's, what are we valuing together? What are our common values? And that's what they hold to. They're likely to be cooperative, mutually supportive. They share tasks, they work together on things, they deeply care about each other's feelings and needs and really take them into account day by day. Beautiful. That's such a lovely account of a good relationship.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking about times that I've eaten out with my husband in restaurants, and I have gotten my attention pulled to a couple who was sitting there making no eye contact, speaking not a word to each other, eating their food, sometimes looking at their cell phones. Mm. They're occupying the same table, but they're not in the same space.
No.
And my husband and I always talk all the time, I mean, to each other. And we were sitting in a diner in the Baltimore, Washington airport in late May of this year. We were about ready to get on a plane to go to our house in Florida where our son was getting married. And we were talking and we were laughing and we were anticipating the event. And this woman sitting next to us across the aisle came over and said, "I just have to tell you that I've been watching you." And you think, okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why? Why? She said, "You are so cute together. You've obviously been married a long time." And she goes on to talk about how we were speaking together and we were laughing. And she said, "I sent my husband a text message that there's this cutest little couple sitting across the aisle from me." And we're thinking, well, that's very nice. Made us a little bit uncomfortable.
Yes.
She said, "Well, you know, we're excited. Our son's getting married. And it's a wonderful event that we're headed to." And she thanked us and she went on her way. And I thought, I guess you never really know what kind of cues you're giving to people in your environment in public places.
Mm,
reading absolutely. Body language, like you're describing, are those little gestures and eye contact and smiles present, or is there a frostiness in a relationship?
Mm. And you're raising the energy of all the people around you. You touched her with that glow. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. lovely. Mm.
Well, tell us, now that we've talked about signs of happy couples, what about the signs of unhappy couples?
These are obvious when you think about it, but it's really important to name them so we really know what they are. So they're likely to be mutually critical, always picking fault with each other. They're the bickering couples, you know, the fractious couples, putting each other down. They're likely to not deal with conflict very well. So they are likely to become resentful. They allow irritations to fester rather than really speak them out. And then you get that frozen anger, the resentment, which is quite bitter and destructive. They're likely to be complaining, always looking for what's wrong, disregarding each other's wishes, feelings, needs, and shaming each other. That's really key. It's so easy to do as well. You know, I don't say I'm above all of this. You know, I catch myself doing it with my partner, and we're both onto it. You know, we say, "Hang on a minute, do we want to go down this path?" You know, it can be, "It wasn't me, it was you." Can get so petty, but actually we pull back from it and say, "No, we don't want to do that. Let's just spend a few minutes being appreciative and understand each other." Mm-hmm. Anyway, so they're likely to tease with a note of bitterness. You know, it's not the, "Oh, wasn't it wonderful when you cooked the spaghetti and it all fell on the floor and didn't we laugh? Well, we soon cleared it up and it was fine and we cooked some more." It would be, "Oh, you were such a klutz, you know. There, you did it again. You're always like that." It's that sort of edge, you know, that is putting down and diminishes the other person's worth, makes them feel sunk inside, makes them feel less confident. So it's humiliation, mocking, rather than to boost each other, it's sort of putting down and unkind, just basic unkindness. They're likely to express disappointment in the other, to express disillusion, have a feeling of helplessness. No, nothing can be done about anything, we're just stuck in this. Resignation, victimhood, and always blaming the other. Rather than thinking, "Hang on, what did I contribute to this?" It was him or it was her. Yeah.
I had grandparents, my father's parents, who behaved towards each other that way. They were always fighting with each other on a low-grade level. And one of the impressions that it made on me as a kid growing up, because we had to go there every Sunday for dinner every Sunday, and we were exposed to this every Sunday. I decided when I got married that if I was annoyed with my husband, I wouldn't show it in public in front of other people.
Yeah.
But they didn't have that filter. And another thing that you said that triggered me is we sometimes work with attorneys who are handling cases of women who have been injured, primarily women in battered wives or battered partner situations. One of the things that is key is that eroding of self-confidence, that you're no good, nobody will ever want you, you can't go out and get a job, you don't have any skills, you shouldn't have any friends, I'm going to keep control of the car keys so that you can't leave. This was the very first article that I ever wrote, was about battered women, because I was fascinated with why did they stay in the relationship? Why didn't they just get out? Mm-hmm. So could you comment on a little bit more on the damage that unhappiness does to the ego of a person who's exposed to those kinds of messages?
Yeah.
And maybe the damage to other people in the family.
Absolutely. Oh, where to begin? It's incremental. That there has to be some complicity. So if I was to look at me in my long ago ex-marriage, I could see that I was complicit in that I gave the power of authority to my ex-husband. He was a very, very bright man and had a very strong self-opinion. And so I would tend to agree with him because he could talk to me logically and take away any sense of whether my feelings mattered or not, because the logic would weigh so heavy. So, for example, when we first got together in the first year or so, he said, well, why don't I move in with you? And I said, well, I don't think I'm ready for that yet. I don't feel like I've known you long enough. And he said, but look, I'm paying rent, you're paying a mortgage. If we lived together, it would be so much cheaper. And that was the start of it. And then lots of other rational reasons why it would be good to live together. And by the end of it, he was so convincing, I said yes. And it was one of the worst decisions I've ever made because I gave away my power. So that was my complicity in that I believed him over listening to my gut. And that was in the early days. We never did get into anything about battering or anything like that, but I deferred to him quite a lot. Hard to believe now, you know, I'm 61 now, I was 30 then, and a young 30. And I deferred to him most of our marriage until finally I put my foot down. I could see it for what it was. But by then, you know, I'd had to go through quite a cycle. If you don't ever get to that point of thinking no, then you can just keep going down. You get depressed. You can lose your sense of self-worth. You can lose your sense of agency, autonomy, all of that. And you can believe that whatever the other person says is right. And quite often this is a narcissistic relationship and codependence, whereas one person is deferring, the other one is taking the power. And that's often from an insecure place as well, but it won't come across that way. But that's why they're so defensive, because the insecurity is inside. They mustn't be humiliated. They mustn't lose an argument. They mustn't be shamed because of what's happened to them in their really early life when they probably were shamed. They probably were bullied. And so they've made a deep decision never to let that happen again. So they control everybody else because there's never been anybody to trust. Mm-hmm. So they can't really believe that they could be loved from the other side. So when they meet somebody who is compliant, that's perfect for them. But that person who's compliant really loses out and can, like you say, can get seriously harmed to the point of physical harm.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question enough?
It does. It does. I think we should scoot back to the happily ever after area.
Yeah, let's.
That's a better one.
Yes. Can I just say, you know, that if any of your people are out there, really seek help. If you recognize yourself in any of that, really seek help. And not necessarily from a couples therapist. Go and get somebody for yourself or a coach. Don't suffer that alone. There are women's refuges if you need them. Just stop it. Yeah, stop it. Yeah.
I can see how couples therapy could be problematic because the stronger person in that relationship is always going to assume a position of I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah.
And this whole thing is your problem. I'm perfectly fine.
Yeah, and it's intractable.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just cannot be shamed. They cannot take responsibility for themselves or they would cave in. So they're apparently stronger, but they're really, really weak inside.
Yeah.
I think we can see that in our politics at the moment, can't we? Across the world.
One of the things that legal nurse consultants get involved in, and this relates to the dynamics in the relationship, is that a couple can really be affected by a change in roles. You know, for example, there's a car accident, person is seriously injured, can't go back to work, needs to be driven to therapy, can't mm-hmm. play with the kids, can't participate in the usual activities. Mm-hmm. All of the dynamics in the relationship shift, and legal nurse consultants pour through those records, read counseling records, summarize those impacts on the patient for the attorneys they are working with. Can you comment a little bit about how a change in roles and the situation I'm describing, how does a couple recover from that without being torn apart by depression or resentment or frustration?
I think it's really, really difficult. In the first instance, I would say that the person who's injured probably has post-traumatic stress, not necessarily disorder, but syndrome probably. So they have an awful lot going on inside themselves on a biological and psychological and almost neurological level, you know, because they are in trauma. They're likely to be in fight and flight really easily. So they might collapse into themselves on an emotional level, or they may be frustrated and go to anger very easily. To the person with them, it may feel like their personality has completely changed. So that's the first piece. The second piece is, if they have lost their role, it's a real assault on their identity. If we think about men for a moment, you know, men really want to protect and provide and procreate, you know, and that doesn't necessarily mean having lots of children, but it means they want to be able to sexually satisfy their wife. They want to be able to care for their children, protect them, be out in the world with them, you know, go to the soccer games, go to the netball games, whatever it is, to be really with them and be seen as the man of the house, and to provide. And if they're not able to provide anymore, that's just such an assault to them. They don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. And they really do need the psychological therapy. And I would say EMDR, well, you're going to ask me what that stands for now, aren't you? It's eye movement desensitization something. I can't bring it to mind in the heat of the moment, but that's a really good treatment for trauma, and it's really quite swift. And you don't have to talk about everything if you don't want to go over it again, which can be re-traumatizing. It's a really, really good method to deal with trauma. From the other side, it's likely, if we say this is husband and wife, that the wife is experiencing secondary trauma, because she will have imagined her husband going through all of these things, or her partner going through mm-hmm. all of these things. She may have seen him in the hospital, you know, all of those awful pictures that you get with people with their tubes in their nose and heart monitors and all of that sort of stuff, or legs in plaster, and the fear that she will go through, that he's not going to make it. And then mm-hmm. when she's delighted that he does, he's a different person with fewer abilities, and it's massive. It's a massive effect on her. And that affects her in terms of her role. I mean, mostly these days women are providers as well, but there's the nurturing role that is then having to be extended as well as being a provider, which is massively stressful. And women have a sort of diffuse attention, so they're keeping tabs on everybody and the emotional effect it's having on everybody. And that is a great strain to hold as well. And wherever either of them get chance to nurture themselves, you know, to do the things that they used to do that filled up their buckets, you know, just fed their soul, there maybe isn't resource or time or physical energy to go and do that because there's so much else to be doing. I think those are the broad headlines. Is there anything that you were particularly thinking about that you'd like me to touch on?
I think you nailed it very effectively, especially the last part of what you said resonates with me. You know, often if the injured person is not working, the resources shrink.
Yeah.
You know, we can't go out to dinner. We can't go to a play. We can't go to a movie. Mm-hmm. We can do things that are inexpensive, like mm-hmm. sitting on the grass or taking a walk. But if there's pain issues or disability issues, even some of those extremely inexpensive or free activities get taken away.
Yeah. And there's huge grief for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
There's a sense of mourning for what was, you know. And also it's the loss of future that is so shocking too. You know, everything that they'd imagined doing together now is, you know, taking a swerve to the left because mm-hmm. that's not the path they're going on anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's move back into the happy world.
Yeah. Let's just send a blessing to those people who are in that world because that's
absolutely
terrible. And hope for better things for them.
We were talking about, first of all, the qualities that help couples stay together, and then mm-hmm. the qualities that are characteristics of couples likely to come apart. And then we got off into the effect of trauma and how that puts strains on relationships.
Yeah.
In terms of staying together, and, you know, and we both know the divorce rate across the world has increased significantly since we were children. And I don't even know what the numbers are in terms of one out of every two couples or what the divorce rate might be. But
it's an ever-present issue. Just to let you know, in the UK, there are about 250,000 marriages a year and 100,000 divorces.
Okay.
And that's just married people, that's not partnered people, and that's mm-hmm. the national statistics for opposite sex marriages. Doesn't include same sex marriages or civil partnerships.
Mm-hmm. What do we do if we're in a relationship that will help us ensure that we're not one of those 100,000 people in Great Britain, if that's where we live?
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry I don't have the figures for more broadly. So it might seem contradictory, but actually what's most important, and like we said, it's one of the things that gets lost when there's crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The path, you know, that you need to follow is self-care. And that might be rest, sleep, fresh air, exercise, good food, you know, being careful about your diet, not drinking too much, all of that. All of the things we know about self-care. But what I really mean is the emotional self-care. I mentioned it before, what feeds your soul? So that might mean listening to your feelings and acting on them for yourself, taking responsibility for your own happiness. So that really means making time for you just to reflect on what you feel and need so that you stay healthy emotionally and mentally. You flourish rather than survive. Yeah. Let me have a think. You avoid self-sacrifice. And that's, if we're talking about men and women, it's a really common trait among women. It's really needed for nurturing and care and raising of children and nurturing of relationships. But if it goes too far, then you lose your sense of self. You can easily become depressed and miserable. And there's nobody for your partner to relate to because mm-hmm. you disappeared. All of the things that were attractive about you in the first place, the fact that you played tennis or you loved art, they've gone. The sparkle goes out of you. So we need to receive as much as we need to give, if not more so, actually. Mm-hmm. We need to think about what truly feeds us. Another important point is to learn about our little self, because we've all got parts of us inside that are very young, vulnerable, parts that hold back, parts that are lonely, maybe self-protective, and they all need listening to and nurturing and including. So part of the self-love is learning to have inner conversations to make sure that your most loving and wise self is driving your relationship life as well as your broader life, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want your three-year-old living your life, making decisions for you. And maybe I can explain that a little bit more. I'll give an example of me. And it may seem a little arrogant to always use me, but I know I'm not betraying any confidences that way. That's yes. really important. So I was in hospital as a baby. I had a dislocated hip at birth, which wasn't discovered until I was 15 months old. So then I was put in the stirrup plaster and also had an operation later on because that didn't work. And there were times when I was left as maybe 18 months, 2 years old, in a hospital on my own. And you can imagine what that's like for a baby. Firstly, I was into the moving and I had to be still. So I've learned to be a talker.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I just grabbed whoever came to my cot. It wasn't about being able to choose if it was my mum or dad, somebody that I knew. I would just grab the next person who came that looked like they were going to care for me. And as a little one, you don't have discernment about who's good, bad, or indifferent. And that's what I took with me as a sort of blueprint into my adult relationships, if you see what I mean. So in seeking love partners, I didn't choose. I waited to be chosen. Whoever came, I would just hold on to. If they showed interest, that was good enough for me. You see mm-hmm. what I'm saying? So if we look at that, you know, I was giving responsibility over for my little self to be looked after by somebody else. I was making them the parent in my relationship and me being the little one. You know, think what I said about my relationship with my ex-husband. It's similar. And those people, you know, the other people can't possibly be a parent to us. They can't. They want to relate with an adult who might support us to care for our little selves, but they can't. And in giving that power to them, we really lose a lot. So don't become the parent or child figure in your relationship. That's really key. So I just want to talk about, because that my trauma there was an obvious trauma, but there may be mm-hmm. other ways that people have their little selves make decisions for them. So, for instance, it might be it's something more subtle, like the birth of another sibling, which many, many people go through. So the eldest child in a family may feel pushed out by the arrival of the next one. They might not feel wanted. They could become resentful, distant, sullen. They could at that point make an emotional decision never to trust again. This isn't a conscious decision. It's a sort of instinctive decision. God, that was so bad. The pain of losing my mom to somebody else was so bad. I'm never going to let anybody get that close again. So that could be one reaction to the situation. Another child in that situation and may become sort of desperate to please, you know, to be the really good child in order that they are accepted and valued and are on the inner side. So you can see the blueprint for being a people pleaser later on and for giving your power away if that's the path you go. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. And certainly we can see how all those factors would affect a relationship.
Yeah.
Much to my surprise, we're at the end of our 30 minutes.
Oh my goodness. We haven't even got to how this can be healed.
That's going to have to be part two, Heather.
Okay. Well, I'm very happy to do that. Oh, that's, oh dear. I don't want to leave everybody in the lurch with all of that sort of pain and distress.
Well, tell us, for the people who are listening, how can they find out more about the services, what you offer? How can they stay in touch with you?
Okay, well, I've got a website, which is heathergarbutt.com. My email address is heather@heathergarbutt.com, so you can contact me that way. It's probably the easiest way. The services that I offer are primarily at the moment twofold. I'm a calling in the one qualified coach, which means I help people get into relationship. And I'm a conscious uncoupling coach, which means I help people get out of relationships that have run their course with real dignity, you know, and respect. And if there are children concerned, with the minimal damage to the children. I love doing both of those things, because getting people into relationships means we deal with all the stuff around little self and healing that, so that they are able to discern who is a healthy person to have a relationship with and are healthier in themselves. And the conscious uncoupling, I just see as a legacy for the future. There may be parting, but they're a family in two households, and there's respect between them. There's cooperation between them, and even affection. Even when things have been acrimonious, we have managed to retrieve some situations, make it possible to not be toxic to each other and not use the children as pawns in that game.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate that contact information. And let me spell Heather's last name. It's G-A-R-B-U-T-T, Garbutt.
Might I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
I'm in the process of writing a coaching program for people who are in couples that have lost their luster. You know, the sparkle's gone out if you've become sort of too hardworking, you've lost that central core of connection that drew you to each other in the first place. I'm writing a coaching program for that. So if anybody would like to be a sort of trial person for that, I would be very happy to hear from them too.
Perfect. All right. Thank you, Heather. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you who's listening to this program. I hope you've gotten some tips from it that you can carry away with you. I know for sure, next time you go out to eat in a restaurant, you're going to be looking around at the people next to you. Think twice about walking up to them and making comments about their relationship, though. Especially the ones who don't look like they're enjoying being together. And with the clues that Heather has shared with us about what makes a healthy relationship, I hope that gives you some inspiration and some guidance. And definitely, for sure, Heather, we'll have you back again so we can talk about the healing piece.
That would be lovely. I'd love to offer that.
If you are watching our YouTube channel, be sure to subscribe to it so that you get updates about these podcasts. We release them in both audio and video format, and they are also on our app, which is BizEdu, which you can download from legalnursebusiness.com/BizEdu. That's it for today, and we'll be back next week with a new interview, a new recording, and new insights to help improve and inspire your legal nurse consulting business.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.